Counsel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and if it pleases the Court, this case involves the interpretation and application of Section 626D of the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Section 626D provides that prior to the institution of a civil action by a private individual under the Act, the individual must give 180 days notice to the Secretary of Labor of their intent to sue, and then must then afford the Secretary of Labor 60 days in which to conciliate or mediate the dispute. The issues presented here are basically twofold. The first issue, and we submit that the case could in fact be decided on a narrower ground, is whether the Court of Appeals improperly intruded upon the equitable discretion of the district court in overturning the decision by the district court that the relative equities in this case did not warrant a tolling of the 180-day time period set forth in Section 626D. The broader grounds is whether Section 626D is a substantive jurisdictional prerequisite to suit, or is more analogous to a statute of limitations, and if it is more analogous to a statute of limitations and thereby subject to similar tolling principles, whether the actions by Mrs. Dart brought this case within one of the recognized tolling principles.
And which do you say it is?
Obviously, Your Honor, our first contention is that it is a substantive jurisdictional prerequisite to suit. We believe that both the clear language of the statute as well as the legislative history indicate a congressional intent to circumscribe the private right of action and to have the 180-day period not modified, except perhaps in very egregious circumstances, certainly not present in the record here. We believe that the legislative history, for instance, indicates that the 180-day period was not initially contained in the House-passed bill. The Senate included the 180-day requirement, and then the House receded to the Senate's request for the 180-day requirement. The 180-day requirement was lobbied extensively for by management in order to circumscribe the private right of action of individuals, and in order to give, we believe, the Department of Labor close to exclusive jurisdiction of age discrimination cases. Employers did not want, we believe the congressional and legislative history shows, employers did not want any private right of action to be maintained because they could see the possibility of frivolous lawsuits being brought, and frivolous lawsuits are, of course, expensive. And it's clear that the employers clearly preferred that there be a limited right for private action only in the first 180-day period, only if notice of intent to sue was given in the 180-day period. We believe also the clear statutory language, which is, of course, the best evidence of what Congress intended, sets forth that such notice shall be filed within 180 days. Mrs. Dart contends, I believe alternatively, that either her oral complaint to the Department of Labor within the 180-day period satisfied or it told the time for her to meet the notice of intent to sue requirement. We think clearly her oral complaint, which she stipulated included no evidence of suing or of an intent to sue shall, we believe her oral complaint clearly did not satisfy the 180-day notice requirement, and the Court of Appeals so found. The Court of Appeals found, however, that the 180-day period was analogous to a statute of limitations and therefore could be told on certain equitable grounds. We believe that even assuming that the Court of Appeals was correct in its holding that the 180-day time period is analogous to a statute of limitations, It certainly was incorrect in finding that, based upon substantial precedent by this Court, that the cases or that the situation here warranted a tolling of that time period. The recognized equitable grounds for tolling a 180-day requirement or statute of limitations requirement are that the defendant has acted in some way to mislead or prevent the plaintiff from acting, that the plaintiff was acting under some kind of recognized legal disability, or that the plaintiff was prevented by operation of law from acting to preserve her rights. We believe the fact situation here establishes, and the record so shows, that all Mrs. Dart did was she called an attorney preliminarily after she felt that she had been discharged because of her age. The attorney didn't tell her of the notice requirement. The attorney told her to go to the Department of Labor. She went to the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor treated her complaint as being a complaint which could activate the administrative investigative mechanisms. The Department of Labor stated that it did not consider her oral complaint to be a notice of intent to sue. In fact, advised Shell that no notice of intent to sue had been filed, and then proceeded to process a complaint. We do not believe that these circumstances indicate. Mrs. Dart, I'm stepping back just a moment, Mrs. Dart also stated that when she went to the Department of Labor, she said, if the Department of Labor would handle it, then why bother with an attorney? Why bother with the expense of an attorney? She was asked in the district court whether she made any inquiry as what was necessary to preserve her rights, if she'd inquired at any time from the Department of Labor as to what she needed to do, and her answer was no, that she did not, that she went to them and she thought they'd take care of everything, and therefore she had properly relied upon them to advise her of her 180-day notice of intent to sue requirement, which the Department of Labor did not do, but which the Court of Appeals found they had no statutory obligation to do.
I take it there's no question of or intimation of bad faith on the part of Shell here, is there?
I believe there's absolutely nothing in the record that would show any bad faith or evil machinations or anything of that nature, Your Honor.
The other side of that coin is how was Shell prejudiced by the result below?
Shell was prejudiced by the result below, Your Honor, because it was never given early on a notice that Mrs. Dart intended to maintain a civil action against it. And
but
the
you,
notice
you certainly
of the,
knew of her discomfiture and concern, didn't you?
I beg your pardon?
I say you certainly knew of her discomfiture and concern.
We knew that she had filed registered an oral complaint with the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor had told Shell that she had not filed any notice of intent to sue. So we knew that the Department of Labor had her complaint before it, that they were in the process of investigating her complaint. It was and is Shell's position that her complaint had absolutely no merit whatsoever, and we fully believed that the Department of Labor, upon a complete investigation, would so find, and we would be without any suit whatsoever. Because we were in the posture where we had no notice of intent to sue, we were not given the opportunity within the time which Congress established to take a close look at the possibility that she was going to sue us and therefore look at settlement in light of nuisance lawsuit value, which may still have been to her benefit, in light of possibly increased litigation expenses. I think that any lawyer who's been in practice knows that when they're dealing with a client, the client tends, when a claim is initiated, say, for instance, a contract claim, someone writes and says, you owe me such and such, and so, that they're not as inclined to settle that case as they are when they get a clear-cut notice through the attorney calling the attorney for the opposing side calling the attorney for the client, or through some other means where they get clear-cut notice that they're going to be sued if they don't settle.
Well, then it's your position that this period of time is a rigid limitation period.
We believe that there's nothing inherently unfair to Mrs. Dart And we believe the district...
You concede there ever might be circumstances where equitable principles or otherwise might lead to an opposing result?
I can see, Your Honor, that in certain rather egregious situations, for instance, I think if Mrs. Dart had been able to show that Shell had immediately upon discharging her hurried her off and locked her up in a Mexican jail for 6 months, and thereby she had been unable to fulfill her notice of intent to sue requirement, and we did this knowing full well that we were prohibiting her from doing that, that fundamental principles of justice would certainly, I think, hold that no one can profit from their own wrong, and therefore that though the time limits could be modified in that situation, although I'm not really sure in that sort of a situation it would even be a tolling so much as it would be an adjustment of the equities.
Well, don't you really have three alternatives here rather than two, the first being the type of limitation that applies when you're filing a notice of appeal from the district court to the court of appeals, that there just virtually are no exceptions for. And the second being the statute of limitations type of thing, that as my brother Blackman suggests, there may well be tolling situations that are fairly well established by law. And the third being a sort of principle of latches, which would be a good deal looser, and where if the defendant couldn't show any prejudice, you might well permit them to proceed without any great showing of equitable tolling principles on their side.
Well, I think that yes, Your Honor, there would certainly be those three possibilities. I believe that the plaintiff, in fact, argued in the district court, although did not continue to press that in the Court of Appeals, to my recollection, that the 180-day requirement was in fact, what I believe they termed as directory rather than mandatory. And that would fall into, I suppose, what you'd call the third classification of cases. I don't really think that that this time limitation, the 180-day time limitation, would fall into the third category of cases. I think that the close analogy, perhaps, of the 180-day requirement here to the 180-day requirement under Title VII indicates that it is, in fact, a jurisdictional prerequisite to suit. The wording of the statute itself indicates that the filing of a notice of intent to sue within the 180-day period is, in fact, a jurisdictional prerequisite to suit. I note in the Senate report on the new possible amendments to the Age Discrimination and Employment Act that the Senate, when they deleted the 180-day requirement from the notice of intent to sue provision, stated that they were deleting the requirement of a notice of intent to sue, which I think kind of tends to indicate that the Senate thought that the 180-day requirement was a substantial requirement. And the legislative history itself indicates that the Senate considered it to be a substantial requirement when the House deleted the 180-day requirement from the Senate-passed bill, and the Senate put it right back in, saying we want there to be a 180-day limitation. So if we were to take the position here that we were going to allow any kind of a tolling, for instance, of the 180-day requirement, I think what we get into, Your Honor, is adopting an approach that the House and the Senate ended up specifically rejecting, because the House bill had provided for the allowance of a filing of a notice of intent to sue any time within the statute of limitations period, the 2-year statute of limitations period. And the Senate said, no, we want a notice of intent to sue filed within 180 days. And I think that indicates very clearly that the Congress considered it to be a substantial requirement. So kind of turning back to the decision by the Court of Appeals. Although the Court of Appeals did not specifically say so, the Court of Appeals, I believe, followed what could be characterized as an extension of the tolling principles enunciated by this Court in Burnett versus New York Central Railroad Company. And the rationale behind the tolling allowed by the Tenth Circuit was that in this particular situation, they felt that the de facto purposes, the filing of the or the registering of the oral complaint, and a subsequent isolated settlement inquiry by the Department of Labor fulfilled the notice and conciliation functions of Section 626D, and therefore there was no particular reason in this situation to not toll the 180-day time limitation. We don't believe that Burnett is controlling here, and we believe that the rationale of Burnett applies to a very, very limited situation. In the first place, Burnett dealt with an ordinary statute of limitations. The Burnett facts were significantly different from the facts present in this particular case. In Burnett, the defendant received all of the notice contemplated by the statute. An otherwise valid complaint was issued. There was no defect in process or in service of process. The only defect was in venue. The fact that there was only a defect in venue was deemed important because Congress had, number one, expressed a desire for uniform time limitations by enacting the statute of limitations provisions in FELA, and to not allow tolling would have caused a substantial non-uniformity in time limitations because many states, as well as the federal government, had savings or venue transfer provisions, and that had the plaintiff resided in any other part of the country than where he did in Burnett, there was a good possibility that his cause of action would have been saved. And this court, looking at the fact that there was only a defect in venue and at the fact that the Congress had indicated a desire for uniform time limitations in FELA, and also noting that the Congress had indicated a desire for saving improperly venued actions by allowing transfer, having enacted a statute to that precise effect, this court decided that there should be a tolling in Burnett. It's also significant in Burnett that the plaintiff would have lost all means of relief. It's also significant in Burnett that the defendant could have waived, according to this court, the defect in venue. If, in fact, the Section 626D requirement is jurisdictional, as we contend, then it is clear, and I think the decisions of this court have so held, that a party cannot waive a jurisdictional defect. It cannot be waived even with consent of the parties, whereas the defect of venue in Burnett could. There was also, and I think this is probably one of the most important differences, there was a fixed time period in Burnett to which the tolling would apply, so that you had clear-cut periods from the time of the institution of the action to the time when the action was dismissed, where you could say, yes, a tolling, in fact, occurred. Here, I don't believe, and I think this would be an interesting question to ask opposing counsel, I don't believe that there's any triggering period where you can say that the statute was tolled here and then starts again here if you allow a tolling for oral complaints. You have an oral complaint filed with the Department of Labor, then when does the statute start to run again? Does it run when they get actual knowledge of the notice requirement? Can this tolling extend indefinitely and thereby toll the 255 two-year statute of limitations? What is the triggering effect of that? We also believe that the express ruling by this court in the Unexcelled Chemical Corporation case with respect to the construction of portal-to-portal time limitations indicates quite clearly that no tolling is permissible of the Section 255 two-year statute of limitations during the period of time that the Secretary is engaging in administrative investigation and conciliation functions under the Act. We have here the portal-to-portal time limitations, assuming that we have what can be characterized here as a statute of limitations. The plaintiff has shown no, Mrs. Dart has shown no circumstances here or no situation here different from what this court was presented in Unexcelled Chemical Corp. And in the Unexcelled Chemical Corporation case, this court expressly held that if Congress thought that prejudice would occur by the fact that there was no tolling of a limitation period during the time when administrative actions of the Department of Labor were being undertaken, then Congress could go about remedying that particular situation.
This act also has a 2-year limitation, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. A 2-year, 3-year if willful, but yes.
Well, what's the sense of having that if you have this 180-day one as jurisdictional?
The 180-day period.
If that is jurisdictional, why do you need the 2-year statute limitation?
Once the plaintiff has filed a notice of intent to sue, then the plaintiff is not required to bring suit immediately, but they must bring suit sometime within the 2-year limitations provision. So the 180-day period is not a limitation provision.
Couldn't I assume from that you couldn't be injured unless it was 2 years? At least Congress didn't think you would be.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I understand that Congress said if you don't file the suit within 2 years, you can't file it. And the reason for that is because if you don't file within 2 years, you would be injured. The employer would be injured. My query is, well, how can you be injured before the 2 years? Specifically at 181 days.
We believe that we can be injured, Your Honor, because the employer and the Department of Labor suits, or an employee and a Department of Labor lawsuit under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, are two entirely different situations. An individual can bring a private right of action. There does not have to be, under Title VII standards, any finding of reasonable cause by the agency. The employee can simply file a suit, good suit, bad suit, frivolous suit, lots of merit to it, no merit to it at all, if they act quickly to preserve that right and act within 180 days to give their notice of intent to sue. On the other hand, the Department of Labor is required to investigate and to weed out frivolous suits, and then to bring suit itself within that 2-year limitation period. And the fact that there's a 2-year limitation period in addition to the 180-day requirement, I think indicates that the 180-day requirement is there for a reason. And we submit that the reason that the 180-day requirement is there is precisely to have the effect which it's had here, which is to weed out the complaints of individuals who do not act within a timely manner to assert their right to file a suit by filing a notice of intent to sue. We think that the arguments that that's a short or too short a time limitation are frankly addressed to the wrong branch of government when they're addressed to this court. In fact, we really think that the fact that they may be short begs the question, or the fact that lawsuits may be dismissed as a result of failure to comply with the 180-day requirement begs the question, because the necessary and expected result of a short limitation is that...
You said it may be dismissed? I thought your argument was it had to be dismissed.
Had to be dismissed.
Yeah, well, you said may. You haven't changed, have you?
Your Honor, I have not changed. No, I do submit that it is a mandatory requirement. And I think we ought to analogize that requirement, in fact, to Title VII standards. Under Title VII, if a charging party does not file a charge with the EEOC within 180 days, their right to sue is lost entirely. And this court has held that particular period, which is over and above the 2-year limitation on back pay under Title VII, is in fact a jurisdictional prerequisite. And I'd point out that the effects on a Title VII plaintiff of applying the 180-day charging requirement as a jurisdictional prerequisite are much more severe than they are here, because here Mrs. Dart still had a remedy expressly approved by Congress. She had instituted a complaint with the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor could, in fact, act on her complaint and could, in fact, sue on her behalf if it were so inclined. So the strict application of the time limitation in this particular situation is much less harsh in operation than it is to strictly apply it in the case of Title VII plaintiffs.
Is the notice function, in your view, a large one here, that is the notice to the employer so that they can assemble, identify the facts and assemble the information promptly before it's lost? Is that a large factor?
I don't really think it is. I think that clearly in 180 days you don't lose sight of the facts or have witnesses die or things of this nature.
After 180 days you might.
Obviously statute of limitations are arbitrary and they're established to cut off rights justifiably or not. But I think that the real purpose of the 180-day requirement is, in fact, to let the employer know that it's going to be sued, because we all know that if you know that you're going to be sued, you're more inclined to go about settling the case in a speedy fashion. It also acts as a trigger to the Department of Labor to let the Department of Labor know which cases it has in its office it needs to devote concerted conciliation activities to hear. For instance, in this case, when Mrs. Dart registered her oral complaint, the Department of Labor just kind of put the case in its normal processing and took a look at it and never asked Shell, even made its preliminary cursory inquiry as to whether Shell was interested in settling until some 80 or better days after the complaint had been registered with it. So the Department of Labor is, I would say, as equally prejudiced as both the plaintiff and the employer are when the notice of intent to sue is not given.
Because none of the Department of Labor prejudice, what did they lose?
The Department of Labor...
What did they lose?
The Department of Labor lost the ability to know when it got
Mrs. Dart. Well, this woman has lost a job, but I mean, what did they lose compared to that?
Comparable to that, I'm not sure. All the same, I do believe that the Department of Labor, in its administration of the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, certainly needs to know when it's supposed to exert exhaustive conciliation efforts and when it's not supposed to exert exhaustive conciliation efforts. Normally, the Department of Labor will not exert exhaustive conciliation efforts until after they've decided there's merit to the charge. However, there's an exception to that, and they will exert exhaustive conciliation efforts where they do get a notice of intent to sue. They did not exert exhaustive conciliation efforts here because they didn't know they had to, because they didn't think they had a notice of intent to sue. And I think that's important. I would like
to
reserve the rest of my
time. You're going into your rebuttal time now. Very well. Mr. Greer.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. When Congress passed the Age Discrimination Act in 1967, they had at that time the benefit of observing the machinery of Title VII for some 3 years. That was passed in 1964. They found that there had been a great deal of delay in Title VII procedures, in that a person would file a charge, which was required to be in writing and under oath, incidentally, and then the EEOC would begin investigating that charge. It would be months and months and sometimes years before they ever got their notice or their right to sue letter. When Congress was considering that, and rather than amending the 1964 Act, which they could have done very easily to cover age discrimination, they chose instead to fit it into the machinery of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Excuse me. Put it under the jurisdiction of the Labor Department. Now, the 60-day limitation, that is a 60-day notice of intent to sue, was, of course, put in there to trigger conciliation. That the Congress was very heavy on conciliation because there are a great many of these cases file. The Labor Department certainly can't bring lawsuits on all of them. And it was the intent of Congress, as shown by their by the records of the hearings, that they certainly wanted conciliation. But further than that, the 60-day notice gives a claimant a right to give that 60-day notice and then get on with his lawsuit. He doesn't have to sit there and wait for months to wait and get this right to sue letter from the EEOC. Now, the 180-day limitation, I think, was placed in there for the same reason, to speed up the procedure, simply to proceed up to speed up the procedure. They, Congress, I think, showed that they wanted conciliation procedures to begin and begin speedily. So the 180 days limitation was placed in there for that purpose. There's nothing in the legislative history that indicates that the Congress intended the 180-day limitation to be jurisdictional. In fact, the latest pronouncement by Senator Williams, who is the floor manager for the Senate-passed bill, which is now in the House Conference Committee, stated very clearly that it has never been our intent that the 180-day notice period be considered a jurisdictional prerequisite.
What would you say if neither claim nor intent to sue notice was filed within 180 days?
No, I think that the 60-day notice, Your Honor, is a prerequisite. Definitely.
Well, it isn't what I asked you. What if neither is filed within 180 days? Neither a claim nor a notice of intent to sue.
Well,
what if nothing happens for 180 days?
For 180 days. Well, I think that's too long.
Well, then it is a jurisdictional provision, isn't it?
Beg pardon?
It is a jurisdictional provision, then, isn't it?
Well, I think you'd have to consider that if you're going to apply equity. You look at all the circumstances.
Well, there are in some circumstances where the 180 days is jurisdictional.
Well, there's been a great deal of confusion as to what the courts call jurisdictional
Whether you call it jurisdictional or not, he's not going to get very far if he doesn't do something within 180 days.
Well, I would agree with that, yes,
and
sir.
And you claim that just filing a claim is enough to toll 180 days.
To toll 180 days? Yes. Well, to filing a complaint with the Labor Department as opposed to a notice to sue?
Yes.
Yes.
So then you would have the full 2 years given you to bring an action in district court once you file a complaint with the Labor Department?
Depending, as in this case, where the complaint served exactly the same purpose as a notice of intent to sue.
Well, when wouldn't it?
Beg pardon?
When wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that.
Well, Congress nevertheless left in this act two different things, the filing of claims and the filing of letters of intent to sue, didn't they?
Yes.
So they didn't. Congress didn't treat them both as the same thing.
No, in practical effect, they have the same the same effect. A complaint to the Labor Department serves under 626B serves exactly the same purpose as a notice of intent to sue. It triggers the secretary's responsibility to investigate, and indeed that's what happened in this case. The claimant filed her complaint.
So if you file a claim within 180 days, you should just forget about the notice of intent to sue.
Well, no, I think that the Congress certainly intended that you file a notice of intent to sue, if it serves the same purpose, here the complaint served the same purpose as the notice of intent to sue. However, in this case, a notice of intent to sue was filed, it was belatedly, of course, some 36 days late. But
you would be making the same arguments if you did it one day before the 2 years expired.
Well, I don't think we could apply equity there if they waited that long. That's
when you is it up to the district court to balance every single individual case as to how many days they waited beyond the 180-day period?
Well, Your Honor, that equity looks at each case individually. We've been doing that for hundreds of years. When you toll a statute of limitation, there has to be equity.
Well, so then your answer is yes.
You would look at each case. Yes, that is right. Yes.
I respectfully suggest that you're getting in trouble using the phrase statute of limitations and arguing latches, and they're two different animals.
Yes.
You keep talking about statute of limitations and an equitable proceeding.
Yes,
aren't you talking about latches?
Yes. Legislative history, if we look at the language of the statutes, the provision for the 60-day limitation is in rather absolute terms. It says no civil action may be commenced until the individual is given notice. And in the 180-day timing provision, it says notice shall be filed. The Section 255 states every action shall be forever barred. Quite different language than that established in 60-day notice. However, even that provision has been held not to always bar the actions, as held in the Humphreys case from the Tenth Circuit. In considering this matter in committee prior to the passage of the Act, industry spokesman there spoke of statute of limitations, and Senator Javits, in considering it, referred to this as a statute of limitations. We suggest that the usual policy of repose, which is a justification for statute of limitations, when it's outweighed by justice, should not be applied, as this court held in the Burnett case. We see nothing in the legislative history to indicate that Congress intended a forfeiture of the claimant's right to file this notice within 180-day person or 180-day period.
Mr. Greer, even if you regard this as a statute of limitations and not jurisdictional in the strictest sense, there's nothing in this case, is there, which would support a fraudulent concealment type of tolling where the defendant is responsible in some way for the delay, fraudulent concealment, or any other kind of conduct?
Your Honor, there's nothing that we would rise to what we would call fraud. Now, Mr. Speer testified that he contacted Speer the very day that claimant made her complaint. That was 9 days on August 9, following her discharge on July 31st. Nothing happened during the negotiations, and he did carry on negotiations with them, until November 27. And they told him at that time that they thought she'd been lawfully discharged and no further negotiations. He said they reached an impasse. They did agree to furnish statistical material to them at that time. But as of March the 5th of 1974, he still had received nothing that he'd requested from Shell Oil. So, yes, they did drag their feet on furnishing the material which he had requested. So, I think we can easily assume that had he gotten the material timely, he could have notified plaintiff before the March 5th that she had this right to sue, which he never told her before. As he stated on the hearing there himself, he blew it. He said he just didn't give her the... didn't tell her about the notice of the right to sue.
There are two people who failed to advise her of the right to sue, of the notice requirement, her lawyer and the Department of Labor.
Well, yes, her Bridge Club member, a lady lawyer there that she consulted, told her to go to the Labor Department. And the Labor Department, yes, they did not inform
her. Should the rule be that whenever an employee consults either a government representative or a lawyer and fails to be properly advised, that then you toll the statute?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the things that you can look at.
Is there precedent for that kind of tolling?
Well, I'm thinking of Love versus Pullman, where the claimant filed under Title VII action. The claimant was supposed to file action in the state agency, instead filed with the federal agency. Now, there never was any claim of any nature filed with the state agency. The federal agency orally advised the state agency that they were holding that claim in abeyance, after which the state agency said, well, we're not going to do anything, so proceed. So acting upon, the most you could say was that they had oral notice from another government agency, and that the claimant never made any notice at all. And the court there said, this serves the purposes of the act, and they held it that was all right. They said to technicalities were particularly inappropriate where a layman initiate the process.
Well, isn't your principal argument then that she complied in substance with the 180-day requirement rather than that the requirement is tolled? They're two quite different arguments.
Well, I think you can justify it either way. I mean, I think there are circumstances here that would justify tolling the 180 days, but I think that the complaint to the Labor Department served exactly the same purpose as the notice of intent to sue. Shell has never been hurt here because they never intended to negotiate anyway. After the notice of intent to sue was served, out of an abundance of caution, Mr. Spear again started negotiations and attempted to carry them on as he had before. He was rebuffed by Shell. They never wanted to settle. We can't see how their position was any different at that point than it was when he originally attempted to negotiate based on the complaint.
Well, I suppose you're hurt whenever you don't get the benefit of a statute of limitations defense that you think you're entitled to. They've got to defend a lawsuit instead of moving to dismiss on the 180-day ground.
Yes, Your Honor, and it's interesting to note that when Shell Oil Company had notice of this complaint, they were on notice that this Labor Department could bring an action at any time and did not have to wait for any notice of intent to sue. They could be sued at any time. So can they seriously contend that we don't know we're going to be sued when the Labor Department is investigating a complaint against them? They had notice that they could be sued, either by the Labor Department or by the claimant.
Yeah, but they're not being sued by the Labor Department. They apparently were satisfied that they wouldn't get sued by the Labor Department.
Well, the Labor Department could file at any time within 2 years.
They could if they thought there was merit to the charge.
Yes. They had not at that point determined it, and they never told Shell that we're not going to sue you. There was never any such statement to Shell, so they couldn't rely on that. It's interesting to note that the Labor Department, charged with the administration of this act, had, since its passage in 1967, taken the position that this was non-jurisdictional. Now, Mr. Spears testified to that on the hearing in district court. And as this court has previously said in the Griggs-Duke Power Company case, the administration's interpretation of an act is entitled to great deference. We suggest that this was not a case where the plaintiff slept on her rights. She did everything that a person could reasonably be expected to do, as the Tenth Circuit found. She sought out counsel. She filed her complaint 9 days after after they'd told her that she didn't have any potential because of her age, and she made repeated calls to the Labor Department asking them what was going on, what's going on my lawsuit, and to get some sort of assurance from Mr. Spear. And she did what the Labor Department poster said. And incidentally, it doesn't have one word on it about any notice of intent to sue. It says, if you think that you have suffered discrimination, go to the local wage and hour office of the Labor Department, which is exactly what she did. We think that every purpose of the act was served. The defendant had notice by virtue of Mr. Spear investigating the complaint. The Labor Department began investigation and conciliation, just as is the intent of the notice of intent to sue. And the Shell has suffered, so far as we can see, no damage by a 36-day delay. Now, the...
Well, your position, I take it then, is that as long as you file a complaint, you need never file a notice of intent to sue.
Well, Your Honor, our contention is that if the complaint serves the same purpose as the notice of intent to sue, which it did in this case...
And it would seem to me it always would, wouldn't it?
Well, I can conceive of situations. There is no time limit within which the Labor Department must negotiate either under a notice of intent to sue or the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
It says he shall do so promptly, whatever that means, but he's the one that, the Labor Department's the one that interprets it.
So your feeling would be if you file a complaint with the Labor Department within 60 days without any more ado, you can file your lawsuit?
If the purpose of the act is served.
Well, suppose the Labor Department gets the notice, gets the complaint, but they're just too busy. They don't try to conciliate at all.
Well, I don't think you could say that the defendant had proper notice then. He must have proper notice. And of course, these two cases that the defendant has relied on so heavy, this Robbins versus Electrical Workers and Johnson versus Railway Express, the court pointed out there that the procedure followed in pursuing two separate remedies did not guarantee notice to the defendant. In the electrical workers' case, they were proceeding under the National Labor Relations Act, the grievance procedure, separate, independent, distinct action.
Well, the purpose of it, I thought you said, was to give the Labor Department time to conciliate, not to give the defendant notice.
Well, it serves to trigger the investigating responsibilities of the Labor Department. It doesn't set any time limit that he
has to
do.
Well, suppose the department doesn't investigate after the claim is filed. Is the claimant entitled to sue after 60 days, or isn't he?
Well, if the defendant has notice, I don't think we could say that. They have to have notice. But our contention
we'll
here is...
We'll have notice when the complaint is filed. I mean, when the lawsuit is filed, they'll have plenty of notice.
Well, yes, but I think that's why they put the 180 days in here, so that the conciliation would begin within 180 days. It's merely to speed up the process that was bogging down Title VII, the 60-day notice.
Well, it sounds to me like then you are saying that there must be something filed besides the complaint with the Labor Department.
Well, no, I'm saying that there must be notice to the defendant, certainly. I don't think that if you just file a complaint and the Labor Department never got around to it, I mean, the defendant certainly has got to have notice that something's
going on.
Well,
so he must do something else besides file a claim.
Well, yes. In this case, the...
And then if he files, after that he files a notice of intent to sue, he files that with the Labor Department, doesn't he?
Yes.
And so then what if the Labor Department doesn't do anything then either?
Well, he can go ahead and bring his lawsuit.
Yeah, even if the defendant doesn't know a thing.
Well, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. That's why they put the 60-day notice in, I believe, is so that the claimant could get on with his lawsuit rather than waiting for the right to sue letter, which has bogged down the Title VII. They experience all kinds of delays in waiting for the right to sue letters. But if I may proceed with the discussion of the electrical workers' case, there you had two separate and distinct remedies, and the claimant had attempted to proceed under the grievance procedure, whereas the court said that that would not afford the notice to the defendant the proceedings under Title VII. Likewise, in Johnson versus Railway Express, you had two separate distinct statutory remedies, one under Title VII, one under Section 1981. But in this case, the plaintiff is proceeding under one statute. There's one remedy, one cause of action. It's whether the Labor Department brings the action or whether the plaintiff brings the action. So, and since the defendant had notice, the purposes of the act were served in all respects, we believe. We think that as the Tenth Circuit held that there was de facto fulfillment and that plaintiff should prevail.
Do you have anything further?
I have.
Counsel?
Excuse me.
Your friend.
There were several questions which were presented to Mr. Greer that I believe warrant some further discussion. I believe Mr. Justice Stevens asked if there was any evidence of fraudulent concealment in this particular case. And Mr. Greer responded that I guess the fraudulent concealment was the supposed dragging of the feet by Shell with respect to furnishing information. First place, I don't think that mere dragging of one's feet would amount to fraudulent concealment under any cases that I know dealing with fraudulent concealment. The second place, there's simply not any evidence in the record that Shell was dragging its feet. There were no statements made by Mr. Spear, the wage and hour investigator, stating that he thought the delay was unreasonable. As a matter of fact, I believe this, the statements to that effect by the Court of Appeals were no more than sheer speculation as to the reasons for the delay. Shell, on the other hand, presented evidence showing that the reasons for the delay was the large amount of data which the Department of Labor wanted. Of course, if the Department of Labor had thought that the delay was unreasonable, the Department of Labor could have subpoenaed the data, which it did not do. As a matter of fact, there's no indication in the record that the Department of Labor even contacted Shell betwixt the time that it requested the data, and Shell called the department some 2.5 months later to say, we're working on it and we're almost through, and we just wanted to let you know where we are. I'm not sure that there's any evidence in the record that would establish fraudulent concealment. Mr. Justice Stevens also, I believe, asked whether there is any precedent for tolling where the government fails to advise a plaintiff of its rights, and I believe Mr. Greer responded that he thought that Love v. Pullman applied to this particular situation. I question Love v. Pullman's applicability. In the first place, in Love v. Pullman, there was at issue whether or not the actions of the government fulfilled the purposes of Title VII, and it appeared that there was wrongful advice, in fact, given with respect to what needed to be done, as opposed to here, which was simply an omission, which Mrs. Dart, we believe, could surely have corrected herself had she made just a minimal inquiry as to, I have to wait with you guys handling this thing any longer, or is there something else I can do? Do I have any other rights? What should I do? Where should I go? How do I proceed? Mrs. Stark did not do that. I believe that Mr. Spear also, or Mr. Greer also stated that Mrs. Dart followed everything that the ADA poster required her to do. In other words, she went to the Department of Labor, and that's what the ADA poster states. I don't know how the ADEA poster's difference, had it in fact included some kind of provision with respect to that, would have helped Mrs. Dart, because she testified before the lower court that she in fact did not see the poster and she never thought it was in fact up, and so we don't believe that there's any evidence based purely upon the alleged inadequacy of the poster for a tolling here.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.